Sul palco sono già saliti il professor Sen, a cui diamo il nostro benvenuto, ed è presente anche Massimo Franco del Corriere della Sera, che lo intervisterà.
Buonasera.
L'intervista sarà in lingua inglese, è disponibile la traduzione simultanea. Vi ringrazio ancora e buon proseguimento.
First of all, let me thank President Carlo Borgomeo for this invitation. I am particularly pleased to interview Professor Sen. Just to remind to myself, he was awarded in 1998 with the Nobel Memorial Prize in Economic Science and in 1999 with the Bharat Ratna Prize, the Jewel of India, which is the highest civilian award of the Republic of India. Presently, Professor Sen teaches at the University of Harvard, economics and philosophy. And I don't want to add anything because I think that the list of his achievements and of the universities where he taught is so long that it would take half of the interview. But starting from the witnesses that we have heard and from the research and the activities of the Foundation with the South, the first question I would like to ask you is, what is the impression of the Italian South, and more in general of Italy, conveyed by this rich discussion?
Yeah, okay, all right. Now, first of all, before even answering that, I should say how thrilled I am to be here and to see all the exciting things that's going on. First like that? Is that more or less so? All right. Okay, yeah. No, it's really thrilling to be here, to hear the work that's being done by the Fondazione Elsud and the also the work that was described, also the three witnesses with which we began. These are very evocative, very touching for me. It's very difficult to dissociate one's own life from the general impression of the kind that you are asking. Of course, I've had the opportunity of being linked with Italy in many different ways. It's the country I studied a lot about, particularly its history of arts and culture. So when I was a student in Cambridge, I remember saving some money to come to Italy in my very first vacation and traveled around. I think I went to 8 or 10 cities. Now, unhappily, that wasn't, Rome was the further south in that tour program that I managed to do. I didn't have very much money, but there was National Union of Students had a what they called a fine arts tour, and the main feature of it was that it was inexpensive, and I was able to go to Venice, Verona, Firenze, Perugia, Rome, Torino, and so on. And so there was remained the desire to go further south, and I did have opportunity later to go also to Palermo and Sicily. I was, I think the notion of the Italian engagement in the south is something which itself is been noticed a great deal in the world, because Italy has a problem which most countries do not have, namely a very dynamic, very advanced part of the country, and many other parts of the country which have resisted that dynamism. And that dynamism is not absent because of a kind of backwardness historically, because quite often these areas were extraordinarily advanced. If one goes around the Greek islands, their connections with Sicily were very strong indeed. I was very struck by that when I was visiting the island of Kos, where Hippocrates was there. The connections were always out of Italy, that's the part of the world that they're concerned with. So I think you're dealing with a kind of rich heritage with a contemporary, I guess one could describe it as poverty in some sense, comparatively speaking. And of course, that has many lessons for many different parts of the world, including India, where there's some similarity of a culture going back 5,000 years, and at the same time, level of poverty, which of course south of Italy does not know, much more extreme. I was personally very fortunate to know a lot about Mezzogiorno, because my first research student in Cambridge was Luigi Spaventa.
Luigi Spaventa.
Yeah. I was very proud of the fact that he was my first research student. I just barely got my degree when I was became a teacher, and he was my first student. And he was working at that time on the South, and the problem of the how to deal with the southern the inequality in Italy and the southern difficulties in being integrated with what's happening in Milan and the rest of the country. I think the general understanding that one has to see the problem in primarily human terms rather than purely economic terms is something which became very clear to me while working with Luigi about that. And this is partly his idea, of course, which, though I was his, meant to be his teacher, learning from him as well. I think this question came up here in the discussion earlier about the role of human development and how to put humanity at the center. That doesn't reduce the role of economics in any way, but it requires us to think about economics.
But you're referring just to mentality, or to culture, or to the way in which ruling classes...
It's the organization of the of all of them, really. The mentality is a feature, but you cannot dissociate that from the circumstances around one. It's a feature that came out in the discussions we had earlier going on in the first part of this program. I think the mentality is an issue. I don't think one could explain any major challenge of a social kind purely in terms of mentality. I don't think one has to, one does not have necessarily have to invoke Karl Marx to say that there's a two-way relationship you have to look at, namely the relationship between the material condition and the state of man, state of mind, and the state of mind and the material conditions working in both directions. And I think if we had more time, we can probably go into the details of that. I would like to know a bit more about what Kwon Il-sung is doing. But some of the things that we, to begin with the features we had heard, there was people of African origin working in Puglia and Fuji, I think. Since I quite like Primitivo as a wine, which is grown, I think, primarily in Puglia, at least the best seems to come from there, I could immediately relate to the fact that there is a part of human life which is at one side creating jobs for people, on the other side satisfying the taste of people who want to drink that kind of wine or that kind of, or enjoy that kind of product. And similarly, at a personal level, since I had cancer when I was 18 and I was given a chance of 15% to live 5 years. That was 64 years ago, so I think I've done reasonably well. It was good for me to hear about oncological treatment that's going on and the participation.
But I've read that your name, Amartya, in Bengali means immortal. So maybe there is something related to this.
I think unrelated to this, because I don't think when I was told I had 15% chance of living 5 years, I did not think that translated into immortality in any sense. No, I think, it's a cognate. It's an Indo-European language. You can see amartya, why A is a denial.
Yeah,
and
alpha privativo.
And the same root as mortality.
Privative alpha, yes, it's yeah. Greek. Yeah.
Yeah. But I don't think I took much confidence about my own future on the basis of my name. But I think the experience of cancer did teach me something, because since I was I was 18 and I was a...
What did it touch you overall?
Hmm?
What did it touch it
well,
teach
it made
you overall?
Me, it made me aware of the fact that if there's a problem, we have to address it. My main difficulty to start with was that I couldn't get my doctor to take an interest in it in Calcutta. I was a student there in Presidency College, and he kept on saying, it was in my mouth, he kept on saying, oh, it's really nothing. And I had read enough. I was staying in a hostel. And next to me was a medical student. So I got him, and it did seem to me a tumor, just on the basis of what I knew, even from my school days. And I wanted him to get some books, and I self-diagnosed that I had squamous cell carcinoma. And indeed, that proved to be exactly right, just on morphological evidence, without any histology at all. My first thing was to get a doctor to actually biopsy me, which I succeeded. I was staying in a hostel, and I had only a local doctor connected with the hostel.
He was a good doctor.
He wasn't, because he told me I had to go away. There's nothing serious. When I went to a public hospital, recently, by the way, I had experience of a good public hospital in Italy, because my wife became very ill in the summer. And I went to Gemelli.
Gemelli, yes.
And I had a fantastic experience there. And she was very well treated. But when I went to the corresponding hospital in Calcutta, nothing to indicate they were not good. But the doctor was mainly trying to assure me that I had no problem. And he wouldn't do biopsy. And when I told him that I believe I have cancer, and I said, I think it may be squamous cell carcinoma. You see, the doctors, of course, always immediately think that you're talking absolute bullshit if you say that. They immediately say, and other than cancer, what other illness do you think you have? And so I had to argue. So I think basically the lesson that I got from that is that you have to be energetic, you have to do something about it.
You have to react.
You have to react, and more than that, you have to overcome. And I think the sudden problem, as such, is not different from that. Because as long as you think that, you know, and that's why I don't like the mentality thing which came in, that it's sudden mentality, then I think you're lost, really. I think there's many things in sudden mentality which we might admire and love. And at the same time, if there is some attitude in life that you want, which is important to change the picture, then those are the attitudes that you have to develop, and nothing is going to prevent you from doing it. So I think I shouldn't become so self-centered to talk about myself.
Well, no.
But there is a connection.
It can be a good advice for against some people who have a mentality. Well, I would say not just in the south of Italy. I would say more in general in the south, but not just in the south. So
it's
a good lesson to listen to.
Yeah, and actually, when later on I was interested in studying not only India but parts of Africa and parts of Latin America, I think this issue of how you see yourself and see the world around you is very important, I thought.
Professor Sen, you have talked about many Souths, Africa, India, Southern Italy, Latin America. They have in common the fact that they are viewed from the North as continents, regions, nations, areas in crisis, which the North is forced to help but is reluctant to help. So I would like to know from you if this is the cliché in Europe, in the West overall. Do you think it is a likely one, or it's too simplistic to explain today's situation in the world?
Well, I think it's a good description of the situation now, but one must not try to construct a picture of this being a kind of perennial feature that's gone on. I think one of the big things I worry about today, let me talk about something for 1 minute before I get to the North-South issue, that it's often what the problems we face today are somehow taken back in the past, and to say that these have gone on for thousands of years, we can't change it. One of the things that's happened is to over-theorize the Sunni-Shia divide within Muslims. When the riots happened in India, for example, and in the British period, there was a tendency to think of this as being a perennial Hindu-Muslim problem going on, whereas for hundreds of years they have lived together without having those problems. I think this is many of the things, ancient hatred that I often hear, are very often modern hatred translated into an ancient picture. So I think there's a little danger of this seeing the North-South thing. I think there is an obligational issue for the North at this moment being more privileged than the South to do it. That's the privilege that comes from anyone who is able to help. I think to quote I'm not religious, but the one religious figure I'm going to quote in this context is Gautam Buddha. It's pronounced differently in Europe. I'm not sure, because it's called Buddha or something like that, but Buddha is his real name, or Buddhism. And he had a wonderful discussion in Sutta Nipata, a book where he's having conversation.
But you have touched a very sensitive point. You have said we tend to undervalue the relation between Sunnis and Shiites.
Yes.
This is very important to Europe and to the West in general, because, as you know, the two obsessions in Europe, in the West today, are immigration and terrorism.
No, I'm going to. But I do want to finish my quoting of Buddha.
Go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, no, because I do, because that's relevant to this. The point he makes that if you have a power to do something which you believe is a good thing, then you have an obligation to do it. It doesn't depend on whether you believe in God or not. Buddha remained agnostic throughout his life.
I know.
And his two points were, A, we would never know whether there is God, and two, you don't need God in order to have the sense of moral obligation. Now, people may dispute it, and I have a lot of friends who would dispute that, but I've tended to believe that. Now, so I think the North is in a position to help many things happening in parts of the South, not all of the South. And I think it has an obligation connected with proximity and connected with what's going on right now in the world, in which they, what you call the North, which is really a Franco-Italian term, the British imperial term is East and West, because the West is advanced, East is backward. That's the picture that that Kipling, Rudyard Kipling would say, that, which is the same as North and South. But along with that, there is, if you have to look at the past, I mean, when, say, Maimonides, a great Jewish leader, is being persecuted in Spain, where does he go? He goes to Morocco first, and then to Egypt. So this is a movement of a refugee, in this case a Jewish refugee, escaping intolerance in Spain, going south, and finding in the court of Emperor Saladin a refuge, which he takes. Yeah. And
now it seems the reverse.
Now we're seeing the reverse. So what I'm saying, therefore, is that the parameters are not north and south. The parameters are privileged and underprivileged at this moment, and how you are connected with this issue. Saladin felt very closely connected. He was, you might remember, a part of the other side in the Crusades, and he was very aware of a Christian Islam distinction. But the fact that he was in a position to help was an important thing for him to decide to help Maimonides, and there were lots of others that went like that. In fact, the strong, large Jewish community, which was very strong in Egypt, has very often come as refugees into Egypt. So I think we have to think of this in terms of the parameters that are relevant, rather than imagine parameters of a perpetual north-south divide, east-west divide, perpetual fight between ancient hatreds of the Sunnis against Shias and Shias against Sunnis, many of which really amount to nothing.
Do you have the impression that today the West and Europe are facing the problem in the way you are depicting it, or in a more selfish way?
I think the temptation to say it's a more selfish way is very strong. And therefore I'm going to, because the amount of help it can provide has not been provided. Some help would be provided. Italy has done very good things and has continued to rescue people.
Quite isolated in Europe, let me say.
Yeah.
Europe doesn't help us very much.
No, I'm aware of that. And that's why I'm mentioning that in particular. But at the same time, the total amount of help is very limited, if you take Europe as a whole. And from that point of view, one would tend to say that it's not doing enough, really. And yet, there is an issue of democracy. And one of the aspects of the democracy is that if you have a commitment to democracy, you cannot do, as a government, more than what the people would allow you to do, because that's what democracy is concerned with. So that, along with that, goes a question of education in the country. Education not in the sense of the, you know, doing calculus of variation in school, but education in the sense of understanding.
Formation, yeah. Understanding.
And that is very critically important here. And we saw some of the things happening, for example, we had President-elect Trump, who will be president in a week, really peddling on prejudices of various kinds that are very strong. We saw exploitation of such prejudices in the context of the Brexit vote in Britain. And by the way, in both cases, the margins were very narrow. In the case of Trump, of course, majority was on the other side.
But you know, Professor, that what is said commonly is that both Trump and Brexit, first Brexit and then Trump, and more in general what we label as populism, which is quite an ambiguous term anyway, that's what we use, are the outcome, the consequence of the refusal of globalization. So in a way they represent the losers of globalization. Do you think that globalization is over or that it is unstoppable, as people like Bill Gates say?
I think it's definitely not over, and I don't think it's got I think the discontent has very little to do with globalization. You know, let me go back a few years when we had this anti-globalization movement.
Brazil.
Well, no, people get together and in places. They got together in Genoa here in Italy.
Oh, yes.
And they got together in London. They got together in many places in the world. And the anti-globalization movement was one of the most globalized movements in the world. People came from everywhere, from New Zealand and Argentina to Genoa, let's say, to protest. I think the terminology was wrong, because what they wanted is a different kind of globalization, and they were providing an example of that, namely that human beings ought to help each other.
So it's not globalization and anti-globalization, it's a different kind of globalization.
That's still the case. The second point to make now is that whenever there are economic changes taking place, and the economic changes, whether you call it globalization or not, are constantly taking place, you have to find it's the role of the state to and society, organizations like CON, ELSUD, to see what others can do to help in the transition. Now, I think the fact is that there were a whole lot of people in America and in Britain who did feel, with justice, that no one really very much cared about them. And I think that is that wasn't quite a good analysis, but it was a plausible analysis. And given that analysis, it's very easy to whip up sentiment, especially if they're political leaders of the kind of...
So you think it was a national phenomenon?
No, I think there are...
Why there, not in other
countries?
There
are losers and gainers all the time in an economic change situation. And I think a bigger aggregate, the state, the society, the community, has a requirement to... They can do something, if I may bring in Gautam Buddha again, and therefore they ought to do something to help in that. And I think the way it proceeds is like this. If there are disaffected people who are not being helped and who have plausible reason to feel neglected, and then somebody, UK for Trump, comes in and makes a... generates a dialogue and generates an anger, a rot, which would make them turn very much against the established order within the country, in case of UKIP, Europe, in case of Trump's, Obama administration, affordable health care, and all that, which are not natural results. They have got nothing to do with affordable health care. They get benefits from it. But we need a much bigger involvement with each other in terms of discussion. I had the privilege recently in October, to speak at the invitation of the Gramsci Institute at the Parliament, Italian Parliament. Chaired by the chair of the parliament. And one of the things that Gramsci discusses is the importance of dialogue and communication. And of course, I was talking about the philosophical problem. in that context, he goes into a theory of language as to why language is the basic of philosophy and how that affects my teacher. One of my closest teachers was Theodor Safa, who was a very close friend of Gramsci, and who was involved with the publications of Gramsci, including the magazine that they jointly edited. Now, and that had an influence in Wittgenstein, and I was talking about how what we call Anglo-American philosophy was strongly influenced by Gramsci's thought indirectly. But that thought had on one side that the philosophical communication is founded on language, and therefore language is very important to understand any kind of philosophy. At the same time, he was also making the point that it is the conversation is absolutely central to our understanding each other. So I think there has been inadequate conversation in Britain, inadequate conversation in America, and I think possibly inadequate communication and conversation in Italy as well. I haven't studied your referendum results, but I don't know how to interpret it. But I think if you look at, take a case, you see, Germany, of course, has a bad record in this terms of this century because of what happened with Nazism. My late wife was Italian, Eva Colonna.
Eva Colonna.
Yeah. Her father was killed.
I know.
By the fascists 2 days in Rome, 2 days before. He was editing the Avanti, underground Avanti. He was killed 2 days before the Rome Americans came to Rome. Not by the German in this case, but it's by the fascists. German influence fascists. I think Mussolini for a long time has resisted it, but in the last moment when his power was completely gone and he himself was of course a fascist, these things happened. But if you look at it today, I think Angela Merkel took a much more friendlier position than almost any of the European leaders at that time, and paid a heavy penalty, is paying a heavy penalty now. And this is one of the cases where a natural thought, which should be natural to all human beings, including all Germans, is making her unpopular because that's the issue about democracy and humanitarianism that I was mentioning. Because there is also, if you're living in a democratic state, you have to carry the people with you. And that is a big issue right now.
The big issue, my impression is that the big issue today is, in Europe, unemployment, terrorism, and immigration. Which of these topics do you consider the most challenging threat to European stability and to European social cohesion?
I don't think I'm going to answer the question because I don't think we have to choose between these three. They are all threats.
All together.
They are all together. And, you know, I think...
A poisonous mixture.
I mean, whenever I arrive in, say, I land in Bombay, somebody says, if there's one thing you can do in India, what would you do? And I said, why should I do one thing rather than 237 different things? There is no reason why... we have to, you see, the choices. I spent half my life doing choice theory. Choice is very important. If you ask, do you want coffee, do you have tea? You have to choose because you can't have both. Or normally, you don't have both.
So which is the best way for you not to be poisoned by these problems? You have a recipe,
you have to consider,
or there are a lot.
You have to consider all three of them. I don't know what it means to say which is the most important of them. They are all very important. And you have to address them all. And they are interlinked, but even if they are not interlinked, we don't have to say that this one is important and therefore that one is not so important. I think we have to address them. Now, unemployment is a very old problem. The peak unemployment was the 1930s. And, of course, it's the period following the First World War was also a period in Germany in particular. Of huge depression. If one wants to read something on it, I would recommend Eric Maria Remarque's book who wrote All Quiet in the Western Front, which is much more well known, but he a later book called Three Comrades, and that's about that period. And John Leonard Keynes was very keen at that time in arguing with the British and French government in not to extract such penalties from Germany, which made German life so miserable, which also tended to generate the Hitler and so on. So I think the unemployment problem exists, and that, of course, need to be addressed at every level. I think youth unemployment was pointed out by, you know, was came up in the discussion earlier, which is extremely important.
Which is overall important in Italy, because if you see the comparison between Italy and other European countries, in Italy the percentage is much higher
than in, say, except Spain, probably.
No, yes, but in Spain you have an average unemployment which is 20% and 30%, say, and youth unemployment is 15. Italy is 40% youth unemployment and 12% average unemployment.
I don't deny Italy has more of a problem. Greece at 55%, by the way, the same number.
Yeah.
At 55, the same data. So, it's a very big problem in Italy, certainly.
So you would say that it's the most important problem
in
Europe.
No, I'm not saying most important problem. It's a very important problem. And the other
superlatives are very important.
What?
Superlatives are very important. Very most.
Yeah, I think. Yeah, I don't know that. Yeah, superlative is very important, but partly because our dialogue, and I'm afraid journalism, has tended to make it more important than they should be. Because, you know, in going for the superlative, there is a danger of missing out really important problem on grounds that they are not the most important problem. So I would resist it, and they are a very important problem, but I think terrorism is a really serious problem too. Since I travel around a lot in the, people often tell me I like traveling. The fact is I hate traveling, but I like being at places where you can go only through traveling. The traveling bit I don't enjoy much, but it's nice to be in Rome, but I couldn't get here without flying. And as a result of it, of course, I'm constantly hearing of the danger of,
terrorism.
There may be a threat and I may be blown up and so forth. And even those who don't travel much, terrorism could be at your door. And even those who are not really threatened have a sense of being threatened by terrorism. And that's quite powerfully present in many societies I know. And not only in Europe, but in India, it's a big stress.
Because Pakistan terrorism.
Yeah, and all the things that I remember from my childhood days. You go into a restaurant, you know, but there's somebody is now checking you. And so
would you explain it just as radicalization of Islam, or there is a deeper malaise that you tend to see in these phenomena?
I think it's taken mostly the form of radicalization of Islam, but it is a deeper and more general malaise. There's also Hindu terrorism too. A lot of people were killed in Gujarat, and some people would blame the party that's in office now in that context. And there's a case there in the Supreme Court still on hanging, but. Numerically, it has been radicalization of Islam played a big part, but it's not the only one that's the case. And some of the ones, some of the killings here in America happening in different places, blown up by lunatics, nothing to do with Islam. And
fundamentalism is a term created by Protestants, not by Islamists, so this is a very Italian thing.
That's true. And I think similarly the migration problem is very serious, both at the end of those who have to leave and those at the end of absorbing it, and as you say, and particularly if a country, if Italy wants to help more than the rest of Europe, that it's a difficulty. Just as if Angela Merkel wants to help more than the German population, that then there is a difficulty. If that could be made into a cause in the Brexit vote, there were a lot of the pictures that were shown of immigrants flowing in were clearly non-European features. At the same time, they were voting about being in Europe or not.
You think
that
for
Italy? Exploited as the basic fear of non-European was exploited by the UK
in order to create
an anti-European feeling.
For Italy, it might be a destabilizing phenomenon.
Yes, Italy has traditionally been it's harder to generate that kind of racist hatred in Italy. But it's not absent, by the way, since I've mentioned Gramsci and Trafa before, one of the two subjects on which Gramsci and Piero Trafa, my teacher, disagreed was on the subject whether there was any anti-Semitism in Italy, where Gramsci maintained that there wasn't, and Trafa maintained that there was. But I would imagine that there would be less anti-Semitism, perhaps, in Italy than elsewhere. But typically, it has been much easier to raise those race kind of issues in more north and more west of Italy than here, and it has been harder in Spain and Portugal, as well as in Italy. Latin cultures have on the whole been more broad-minded in this respect.
Which values, in your view, are prevailing today in Italy and in Europe?
No, I'd like to hear.
And which one are fading away?
You know,
because, for instance, we understand that welfare tends to be over, that there is a more crude approach to jobs, to employment, and in human relations. So I think that the widespread mood is people feel unsafe, and they think that a world is finished, but we don't know what's coming next.
I think that that's a council of despair, for which there's very little factual basis. I think the reason why Europe needed a welfare state or needed a national health service is as true now as it was when it was initiated in the 1940s and 50s. Nothing has changed in that respect. I think we went through, Albert Hirschman has a book called Shifting Involvement, where he sees them in cyclical terms, that you have a lot of welfare state-type activity, and that dominates, as it did, your 50s and 60s. And then in 70s it starts changing, and then there is a much more of a opposite movement. And I think right now then there's some tendency. I think Bernie Sanders would be a good example of that, of the United States, that it can move in the opposite direction, and I think it probably will. And I'm certain it will if they do repeal the Affordable Health Care Act now, because there are a huge number of people whose lives will be in jeopardy as a result of that. No, I think, I don't think any of those things have gone away. And there was a time when it was easier to argue that private care provides better. Now, there's very little evidence of that, actually. It's certainly true that if you want to get the highest specialist care centers in America, including connected with my own university, Harvard Medical School, have something to offer, but it's nothing to do with public and private in general. In a tiny way, in my own experience, In the summer, we had an operation. My wife had to have an emergency operation at Gemelli. It's a public hospital, though connected with a church. It went absolutely perfectly. I think the surgeon was Dr. Antinori, and it was extremely well done. There was no problem. But it had to be completed. I have to complete the story.
Sorry.
And yeah, because I'm making a point. I know journalists are very ready to stop others. But I had to stop journalists in this case. And then she had to follow, the follow-up operation was done in Harvard, connected with Harvard Medical School, but Mass General Hospital, which is one of the best hospitals in the country, in the private hospital. She emerged from it having an infection from the surgery in the best hospital, and what would have been a 1 week recovery produced 2 months of recovery. So if I had to compare a public hospital in Italy and the best private hospital in America, I'll have to give credit to the public hospital in Italy.
Great.
And that being the case, don't be a nationalist. I'm making a point about public and private. And in the public context, I would say it indicates that a public hospital could be better and certainly no worse than a private hospital. So I think quite a lot of the thing that people, that drove, for example, Thatcherism. I think Thatcher did a lot of good in some respects. In particularly dealing with the organizational side, what's the role of the union and so on, even though initially I thought she was too extreme. But the general idea that privatization is a better thing even for hospitals is just wrong. And there's no reason to believe that. There's no evidence for it in medicine. There's no evidence for it in education. There's no evidence for it in a lot of things, with the exception, I would say, if you're looking at agriculture or manufacturing, I think there is a lot to be said for private enterprise there, and there's just empirically, which is really a big divide. But when it comes to education, healthcare, social security, safety nets, you need
welfare.
Public welfare. You need it as much and as strongly.
May I stop you?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Can. You can. Now it's your turn. I'm sorry.
No.
Forgive me.
Now I would like to go ahead with 100 more questions, but time is running out. So the last question for you, Professor Sen, is I refer to what you said before and what is quite widely known, that you are agnostic. But is there anything you believe in very strongly, in which you pose your faith, excluding religion, of course?
Well, I don't know.
That's an answer.
That is, if you take it as an answer, I'd be delighted. But I didn't mean it as an answer. I think if you believe that any of these decisions have to be taken on the basis of the reasoning, the best reasoning you have at hand, I don't think you can give an answer that is immutable, because you can get different evidence which indicates that...
So reason is your faith in a way.
Yeah, I think the priority of reason doesn't allow you to have an immovable object of faith. and that I think is a position, I mean, I'm aware of the fact that since we began with immortality, I come back to it, that I'm mortal and I'm 83. I quite enjoy living. I liked when Woody Allen was asked whether he would like to be immortal by being remembered. And he said, no, I would not like to be immortal by being remembered. I would like to be immortal by not dying. And I think my position is quite similar. I enjoy life. And that, it's a bit of a faith. And I have great faith that I'll continue to enjoy life unless I get really badly ill.
And we hope as well for you and for us.
So thank you.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for your frankness. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you.
Vorrei dare la parola adesso al presidente della Fondazione con il Sud, Carlo Borgomeo.
Yes, I did indeed. Thank you.